Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. We are crawling towards the end of the legislative
over broken
session.
Glass.
Happy to be joined today by Josh Blank, research director for the Texas Politics Project. It's Friday, Josh, in case you were wondering what day of the week it is.
I don't know. Okay.
We're sitting down to record on Friday morning because we had some scheduling conflicts this week. We got about 10 days left in the regular session. Now, last week we rounded up what was still outstanding and kind of left in the regular session. To the legislature's credit, I suppose. lots happened in the last week.
Yeah.
Things remain, I think, chaotic, having been around a lot of Capitol people in the last, 24 hours, 48 hours. You know, there's still a lot of grumpiness, fatigue, raw nerves out there. But things have moved. So let's talk about a couple of the major developments this week based on what we had seen last week and what we talked about last week. So the House is now, at least from the view of the Senate, catching up. And I said, put that in brackets for all the House cats out there. But the House has kind of caught up, passed some versions of some major legislation that was still outstanding when we talked last week. Top of the list has to be, I think, HB2, the school funding bill, which, as we're recording Friday morning, passed the Senate last evening. Arguably, at least in the marquee items, looks a bit more like the Senate bill than the House bill.
Right.
Particularly in the approach to, raising formula funding versus directing funds in other directions. Mm-hmm. The per student allotment increase is that $55, which, as somebody I know seemed like a big middle finger from the Senate when it was first offered, but seems to be where we've landed.
Yeah.
So, we were talking about this before we came on, and, it's an interesting policy approach at work here, given the overall arc of the long-term debates over school spending and what to do about public education finance.
Yeah, this is a huge, huge topic, and we're only going to just sort of skim just the surface of the politics of this a little bit here. But, I think that's the thing that's kind of interesting about this. There's a lot of different sort of ways I think you could kind of see this and read it. And they can all sort of be true, but, in the end, it's probably some combination of them. So let's sort of talk about a couple of them. So, one is kind of the obvious, which is say this is the middle finger, right? The House said we want to do this much in formula funding. You guys said it's $55. And, at this point, we're kind of where we are in the session. We're going to take what we can get. Well, I think that's a little rough at this point. I think looking at where we're at, and part of it is, I think if you look at the way that the bill has shaken out, and I think, I'm just talking about the major pieces here and the way that they've negotiated this, one of the big issues has been this question of, if you increase the basic allotment, essentially what is the consequence of that, both going forward, but then also how does that money get distributed? And this was a big issue as well.
Because the overall, this argument has not been about the chunk of money. The chunk of money has been pretty steady the whole time.
And that's what I think that's another dimension to this, is this hasn't really been about whether or not to spend the money. It's been about how to spend the money. And so again, I think there's been a lot of agreement about how much. It's been about how. And a lot of the friction here was, when you do the formula funding, it gives the school districts a lot of flexibility. Not 100% flexibility. Most of that money, well, not most of it, I think 40% of it has to go towards teacher salaries. However, the legislature wanted a little bit more control over this. And I think, in some ways you could say that's not unreasonable. And one of the things that they did in particular was with the lower per student funding, they were also specifically allotting money to provide increased salaries, specifically for counselors, librarians, nurses, and support staff, which was a big piece of the sort of discussion on the side of the schools.
And it was a big part of that discussion in last session. Too.
Yeah, it was one of the limitations about going with the, formula funding increase as the sole thing. So there's a policy debate, argument there. Now, I think there's also another political overlay that we could also consider here, which is, and we talked about this on the podcast a lot, the fiscal outlook going forward is probably not great. And ultimately, when you increase the per student funding, you know, what you're doing is you're making a commitment essentially to pay, you know, again, however many students come into the system and are in the formula, like you're going to pay that money out every time going forward as an ongoing commitment. If you think about it, let's say they had raised it by $400 or so, and then they come back in a tougher fiscal environment, like, well, you know what? We actually need to decrease the per student funding now. That would be very politically tough. Now, if they've gone and put, you know, let's say $500 million for districts to increase salaries for nurses, librarians, it's a lot easier to say, well, you know, we need to turn that back a bit, right? We need to mess around with some of these other things. And so this probably gives them some flexibility going forward. And we'll probably come back to this, but this also speaks to the fact that this notion of, you know, the House is conservative or the Senate is conservative or somebody's the cooling source of the other. It's like these arguments can get a little bit oversimplistic. Right. And I think, you know, if you're a House member right now, even if you're a, you know, let's say you could be a conservative Republican House member who nonetheless, you know, wanted to see the increase in funds, voted for the initial bill. You know, you get to say, yeah, you know, look, I go back to your school district and say, hey, look, you know, I voted for the $400 per student increase. Ultimately, you know, we came to something else. It was, I think, still gets you a lot of the things you wanted done. I would have liked to see the per student higher, but, you know, we're making a good progress here. So, and you get to say both. And that's kind of nice. And it was the Senate who actually had to go and say, well, we're going to chip this back.
Yeah. And that's really the conversation with your superintendents and a few people that you might see at some of your town halls. I think, you know, when you step back and, you know, step back and kind of put the wide lens back on it for a minute, you know, a pretty good development that they seem to have settled this in a way that is going to be pretty passable in both chambers.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about this before. It's like, even if you're a Democrat in the House who says like, hey, if you have, you know, qualms with the way that the money's being distributed, you may bring those up, you know, again, when you vote on the substitute, on the, you know, the conference committee report, but like, ultimately you're not going to vote against this. What is ultimately a big increase in funding.
There is consensus here, and it'll be interesting to hear and read, you know, see who does some work on this about the actual, if somebody does a process story on what the negotiations look like and how they went.
I will say, just to flag one more thing on this, you know, given all the discussion that went on this time about the per student funding and the formulas and the role of inflation and how much the state is spending per student, you know, I'm just going to say, like, looking ahead, this is not a conversation that's probably going to go away come 2027.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, they've essentially punted the inflation question down the road. And the fact is that, you know, with $55, they're probably still not spending more per student than they were in 2019. And that's just going to get, that gap's going to get bigger.
Right. And which we will be hearing about, I'm sure. But yeah, so, but big picture, the thing that broke last session, we've got the, you know, the voucher bill is, ESA bill is signed, a done deal. This seems pretty close. So we seem to have overcome, you know, that part of the logjam. You know, and credit where credit's due, I will also, you know, well, we'll come to this in a second. We'll give the credit in a minute.
Okay.
Because it follows off the next thing. Now, the other kind of thing that was out there last week that we talked about, and we wrote about this on the Texas Politics Project website and the blog. If you go to the website at texaspolitics.utexas.edu, you'll see the piece that's ostensibly about, or, you know, the point of departure was the hemp bill, SB3, which got passed in the House in an interesting, you know, if you follow legislative stuff, a amendment on the floor that essentially turned the House bill that came out of committee into the Senate bill.
Yeah.
Returned it much more closely to the Senate bill. And, you know, that's fine. And people knew that was going to happen. I mean, you know, by fine, it's, you know, within the rules.
Right.
But not something you see all the time.
Yeah, I was going to say,
it's pretty rare to see a major substitution like that.
Because that's basically almost a substitute, right?
It would have been...
Like if it was in the committee,
if they had done it in committee, it would have been a committee substitute because the amendment substantially rewrote the bill and made it, you know, brought it back in line with what SB3 was, which is it was more punitive, more restrictive. It's essentially a ban on all consumable hemp products, low level THC and synthetic Delta 8, Delta 9, and, you know, from the business, if there's any kind of a play in this, as we see what the end game is going to be in it going to the governor's desk, is that, you know, this is going to be a pretty big is a pretty big economic sector or subsector has grown out of this.
Right.
And, you know, if the governor doesn't want to sign the bill, and if I had to bet, I think he's more likely to sign it than not.
Yeah.
But if they were looking for a way to not sign it, that's what the argument will be. This, you know, was too big a piece. Right. But in terms of like the frame we're putting on this, that passed this week. And the bail restrictions bill passed in the House, which had come out of the Senate a long time ago. Both of these bills looking a lot more like the Senate bill than the House, than what the House seemed to have wanted, right? Which brings me to the credit where credit due pieces. You know, Scott Braddock had an interesting piece in Quorum Report. And one thing that really stuck out to me was him kind of replaying how the House played the timing of the passage of the ESA bill, which by doing something that we expected them to do at the time, which was let's get this voucher bill this ESA bill passed as soon as we can,
right, get it off her,
and turn the temperature down on that issue in the House and begin to try to bring the House together after the speaker race,
right?
Which all made sense at the time. But Scott did point out that by having that bill off the table and not part of negotiations, it did give the lieutenant governor and ostensibly the Senate, but, you know, we can, I think, use those terms pretty close to interchangeably at this point, more leverage to push some of these other, you know, arguably, I don't want to say secondary, but the lower end of the top tier of the priorities.
Yeah.
Right. In other words, the pot bill and the bail restriction bill. Now, the bail restriction bill, you have to put an asterisk on.
Yeah.
But I think the pot bill is the better example here that,
you
know, that being able to, you know, bring SB3 into the negotiations when one of the big things that could have been part of that, that you're trying to get across the border is already off.
Yeah. I think that's it's a good argument. I will say there's a couple things about it that I'm just a little I just have to be a little bit unsure of. I mean, one would be to say, these are multi-stage games, right? So if the House sits, and I'm just thinking about, the argument, if the House sits on the voucher bill, ultimately Patrick is going to react in other ways. And so it's not as simple as saying, there's our piece of leverage.
Right.
I'd also say to some extent, the primaries and everything that happened both at the end of the last session into this session kind of makes that a different issue. It's not really just a horse trading issue at this point. It's something a lot more than that. So it's not really, if it's on a table, it's on a different table.
But except that the counter argument that would be, but that's why you wanted to hold it.
I think that's true, but I'd also think
if you could.
Yeah, if you could. And I think that's the thing there's so much cost to holding it up, and there's so many guys who got elected specifically with the, idea and the support to go and move this thing forward, not from the electorate, but from funders, from donors, from, again, leadership, so on and so forth. The other thing I'd say is, I'm not sure that the House, I mean, I guess, and I don't know this, but I'm not sure, and I'm sure somebody does know this, so I'll just ask this question. I'll say, I have an answer maybe in Ryan as I'm saying it out loud. And I wonder if the House as a body, how aware they were that the Senate was just going to take their version of vouchers, because they were very different, right? So the Senate version was a pretty different, I mean, it was reasonable to expect when the House sent that back that would have been in a conference committee and that would still be a point of negotiation potentially. Less of one, because if it comes back, it's going to be hard to vote against. But, I mean, the fact that they, when they did just accept it, that was a bit of a surprise. I was like, oh, okay, that's the bill.
Well, I think the answer to that is probably...
I'm sure the people who needed to know
there's
knew.
Something different. Yeah, right. I mean,
that's what I was thinking.
What everybody in the House knew is not the same as what the leadership team knew, particularly given that we do know that, or we think we know, based on what everybody's, the participants are saying, that the lines of communication between the speaker and the lieutenant governor and their offices was much more direct this time.
Right.
But I mean, I see what you're saying. Yeah. I think, I guess the way I would put that is that the politics of the immediate aftermath of the speaker's race and the way that went were pretty overdetermining in the moment.
Yeah, that's right.
So, there is something to be said for, that the argument, that I was.
I wish I hadn't done that thing that I had to do then.
Yeah.
But
in retrospect, maybe I could have done this differently, but.
That's the nature of retrospect.
There's a little bit of.
But anyway, to your point, though, I mean, that's a little bit of a sidetrack. But then the other piece of this would be to say, and this is what the piece is about a little bit, is that you know, sort of the, fundamentally by moving forward both on bail, which we talked about a little bit, I think, in the at least on a couple of these podcasts, which is a little bit easier, but also on this much more restrictive, you know, generally sort of, you know, marijuana THC synthetic bill, you know, Patrick really moved the House significantly in his direction. We say, like, what do you mean by that? And this is kind of what we go through in the piece, which is to say, you know, in the House in particular, there's been certainly a flirtation or a consideration with, you know, what has been sort of a criminal justice reform movement that has been seated on both the far left and the far right in a lot of cases around basically, you know, issues that range from, you know, fiscal concerns about the overpopulation of prisons on sort of people on like low level drug charges, concerns about liberty, concerns about the fairness. And again, people can come to this movement for different reasons, but ultimately there is a coalition that began well over a decade ago that was trying to essentially get people out of prison.
Right.
Again, just to simplify, these are obviously two bills that are more about increasing punishments around people around, you know, again, an issue that usually lands people in prison and again, in this specific space, and also obviously makes it harder to let people out of prison on certain circumstances.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, again, that's oversimplifying pieces of it, but this is why it wasn't necessarily a slam dunk that the House was just going to come along when Patrick threatened a special session and kind of come to heel.
Yeah, I know. I will say I was a little surprised that this played out this way.
Yeah.
I was expecting a milder bill in the House and then some kind of, you know, much more detailed negotiation over the issue. And I think, you know, it does lead to, you know, the general interpretation that, you know, basically the lieutenant governor reached into the House and, you know, with Representative Oliverson's help,
who's been very helpful,
basically, you know, move the House, you know, just, you know, drag the House in his direction, and the House ultimately went along with it. So, the other piece, then, sticking with the legislative stuff for a second, and there's another thing that we were going to talk about, but I'm going to move it into this next block,
I think,
which is, you know, so the big thing that's hanging out there that's not been passed, the big thing, is the budget,
right?
That we've not, you know, the budget bills have not been passed, and often the budget doesn't get done till the very end as all these other pieces are falling into place. So you have a better sense of, you know, what you're going to need to be in that bill. You know, the school funding bill, obviously a very big piece of that.
Right.
But the, you know, the final budget is still out there. And just to sort of tie something else that happened just very recently this week in Washington, D.C., that is bears to that, and we've talked about it a lot in here, is that there is money apparently in the budget that, after a very torturous process, came out of the U.S. House of Representatives this week. And it includes what, $12 billion to compensate border states for their, you know, the need for them to spend money during the, you know, failed Biden administration, quote unquote. And our expectation is that a big chunk of that will go to Texas. Now, you and I were talking about this earlier.
Right.
If it's proportional to what people have spent, then it makes sense that
Texas will get a lot.
Should get most of that, or get a, you know, a bit of it. And we had asked about that. We asked in the February poll whether people thought the federal government should reimburse Texas.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, almost a majority, 44% said that Texas should be, you know, fully reimbursed. You know, 23% said partially. But, you know, I think more importantly, when we're sort of thinking about, you know, the impulses here, you know, 63% of Republicans said that, you know, the U.S., you know, federal government should fully reimburse Texas. 73% of those voters who say they're extremely conservative said the federal government should fully reimburse Texas. So this is, you know, this is kind of an easy, I mean, this could be an easy win for a lot of Republican Congress people right now.
And as we've been
going into what may be a little bit of a tough election cycle.
Yeah. And the thing is, this is not going to be resolved at the national level before presumably this is done.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, the legislature blows out this weekend and we can have a big weekend, which we'll talk about. But again, you know, it's one more little nugget for thinking about how much that border, you know, what the border number in this budget is going to be when it's over.
Yeah. And, you know, it's these numbers, it's funny, they can get really abstract. And I was looking at stuff just this morning for myself. You know, I was looking, you know, what's the biennial cost estimate of like raising the homestead exemption from 100 to 140,000? It's about $1 billion over a biennium, you know, and it's sort of, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the $55 is sort of interesting, but you know, if you were, this is a little bit tougher. I'm gonna say this is a very back of the envelope calculation, but if you look at what's, you know, what is the biennium cost and this is an estimate, and if someone wants to email me, I'll tell you how I estimated it, of, you know, increasing, you know, the allotment by about $55. You know, it's a little under a billion. It's about that kind of, you know. And you sort of look around and say, you know, if you look at it that way, say, you know, if, even if Texas gets 6 billion of that 12, that's useful. I mean, that really speaks to some big budget things. And honestly, in the next couple, and again, in the biennium's coming up, they may really want that money if they can get their hands on it, especially if they can also decrease some of the money they're spending on border security at the same time, going into what's going to be, again, probably a tough fiscal environment.
Yeah. And I thought, you know, so I thought that was an interesting, you know, it's an interesting piece of this, of something that we've been tracking kind of, you know, slightly back burnery. So in terms of, you know, things that still need to be worked on, the House is going to be in all weekend. They're in today. The Saturday calendar is a monster.
Right. Yeah.
It's many pages.
Get your popcorn.
And it has, you know, many of the big outstanding issues are on there. A bunch of the big grid bills. So the big grid bills and even some of the mid-tier energy bills are kind of floating around on there. The state lottery bill still out there. The water bill. State oversight on public universities, SB 37. A lot of discussion of that in these halls. The K through 12 DEI ban, you know, lots of things that are still out there and that are going to have not quite been reconciled. They're bringing back the Ten Commandment bills, was sent back on a point of order earlier this week, SB 10.
With the witness list.
That's on the calendar Saturday. So look at that Saturday calendar is what I'm saying. A lot of stuff going on there. And, you know, at that point where, you know, there's no way they're going to do all the stuff that's on these calendars.
Yeah.
And so the maneuvering around this should be pretty interesting. So, you know, I mean, this is one of those that was so much pending and, you know, so many things that are in various stages of the process, you know, have gone through both houses, things going to conference, et cetera, things still, you know, being reviewed on the floor of the House and even to some extent in the Senate. You know, it's an interesting time for like a vibe check, but not quite the postmortem because it ain't over, right? So, you know, I mean, we've already kind of started on this. You know, I think it was you that was saying the other day that, you know, this is a moment in which Dan Patrick is at the apex of his power. Was that you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so. So,
yeah,
you know, the SB 3 hemp bill was an interesting display of that. If, you know, I think I had some language like this in the thing we wrote and we wound up taking it out or whatever. But I, you know, I still find it a curious thing that of all the things that, you know, has gotten a lot of attention and that, you know, we can read a lot into, and I think we can read a lot into this.
Yeah.
But, you know, it has been a pretty good session for Dan Patrick. I mean, I think he has, you know, without making judgments about, you know, most powerful ever, blah, 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 whatever, which is fair enough. But, you know, we have learned some, you know, I'll put it this way, we've been reminded of some very interesting things about the way Texas politics and government work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's one of those continuity and change things.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you step back and you take the names off of all of this,
yeah,
you would say, you know, I would expect that if you have a new Speaker of the House, elected by a majority of Democrats and a minority of his own party caucus, and you have a lieutenant governor who has been in the office for a decade and, you know, has engineered a Senate very much, at least a Republican caucus, very much to his liking, that you would expect that lieutenant governor to have a pretty good session.
Yeah, well,
and I'm not trying to like not give Patrick credit because I mean, look, he clearly has demonstrated over and over and over again that he is a shrewd, intelligent player at this game.
Yeah.
But there is something that's kind of like, you know, and look, what's occurring to me is the conversation we're having 10 minutes ago, right? And that's how you kind of square your skepticism of the of Braddock's argument, right? Which is, well, yeah, all things being equal, there might have been a different way to play this, to move these pieces around. But, you know, the first thing that had to be pretty high in Dustin Burrow's agenda was solidifying his position in the House, because he was a new speaker elected under those conditions.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's, I guess what I'm getting at is that there is, you know, there is a kind of relational piece of this that is also part of why the lieutenant governor has had such a good session.
Yeah. I mean, I'd add to that particular observation that, you know, whereas you can probably make a credible case that the speakers who have been elected previously were at least elected somewhat in part to stand up to Dan Patrick when necessary, that's been much less the case with Dustin Burrow's election. They actually wanted a bit of a normalization, a bit of a thawing of the relationship, so they didn't have to have all those problems.
Yeah, I think there's a little battle weariness, I think, among...
Yeah.
I mean, look, what's interesting is the mixture, right? Because clearly there's that sense among a lot of the members, at least some of them, particularly some members of the... But there's also the other piece, which is, you know, Patrick has the largest contingent that he's had to date of foot soldiers in the House.
That's exactly right. I was going to say that. I mean, that's the other piece of this, too, is that, you know, there are people who are replaced specifically along the dimensions along which they were all going to fall on Patrick's side on every issue, basically. I mean, so there's...
Well, right. And it's, you know, and it is, given how much we've talked in the past about here, how people have to understand how important, I mean, this is not inconsistent with that, you know, the built-in tension between the House and the Senate is, you know, the way the thing is built. You know, it is, I don't have a shred of data in this other than observation, but it does seem like it has happened much more this session that you've seen House members go to the back mic and make some phony baloney parliamentary inquiry, the point of which is to say the Senate's doing stuff and we're not.
Yeah.
And you're seeing a lot more of people, you know, like the far right members. I think, you know, somebody can write me if I'm making that. You know, certainly I've seen Toth and Money do this, Representative Money talk, you know, laying out bills or defending legislation or amendments and very explicitly saying, well, you know, the Senate has done this and we're laggards.
Yeah.
I feel like you just didn't use this. The frequency of that is much higher than it's a function.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, the member-on-member violence around that kind of thing is a lot higher. Around the process seems to be a lot more, you know,
well,
part
of it. And specifically, just the specific kind of going, hey, the Senate's doing a better job than us.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not something you've heard very much in the House historically, to my memory.
Well, as I say, you know, when I was saying that thing about Dan Patrick being at the apex of his power, and it wasn't just the pliant Senate, it wasn't just the fact that, you know, he has more allies in the House. It wasn't the fact that, you know, he has, you know, more allies or a better ally in the current speaker and all those things.
Yeah.
But it's also the fact of, you know, his relationship with Donald Trump and Donald Trump's place in the party right now puts Patrick in a very, very powerful position.
Yeah.
Because the reality is, like, look, if you're a House member, you want to go out and say, you know, your Republican House member, you want to say, you know, go to the back mic, say, you know, the lieutenant governor is being a tyrant. Honestly, you're going to have a primary challenger essentially going to be endorsed by the president.
Yeah.
Like in your random, you know, primary, in a random Republican primary in a Texas House district, like that's going to happen. And like, that's a real threat. I don't think I'm exaggerating here.
Well, because there's an empirical basis.
But I would say, but I was going to say, you know, in addition to the apex of his power, that, and we've talked about this with Abbott a bit, you know, in the sense that each session they get a new chance to plan. I think also, you know, look, I think Patrick has had, and I mean, we'll get to Burroughs too, but I think Patrick's had a really good session the way that he's played the issues that he wants to play in.
Mm-hmm.
Now, part of that might have to do with some amount of coordination between him and with Abbott and with Burroughs potentially. Some of it may be just knowing where to, like, you know, step back and not be the lead person on some things. But we've talked about this a lot, but the way that he handled, you know, the lottery vis-a-vis gambling, the way that, again, the pot issue played out in particular to his favor. You know, but it's not all one way. I mean, you know, again, to this whole, we sort of talk about these multiple dimensions of this, but it's like, you know, okay, the simple version is the Senate's more conservative. They pass everything super conservative bills are basically sent it to the House and then they yell at the House. And it's like, if you watch a session, like, well, you know, that may have described some like prior sessions, but that's not described what's going on here. And you think about the fact that the voucher bill that went back to the Senate was the House's voucher bill and they just took it, right? So when they sent them, what they sent them was an empty shell and said, fill this in. They got it back. They said, great, you know, and you're seeing these sort of things go on right now where the Senate in some cases is moderating some of the bills that the House sends back. But I think what you've seen is that, you know, I think probably, and I, you know, I'm probably just giving of this, I'm just speculating on in terms of giving credit here, but I think Patrick has given the House to operate where it needs the space to operate.
Yeah.
And he's turned the screws in spaces where he feels like he can turn the screws effectively. And it's not just the fact that he's at the apex of his power, but I think he's using it to the greatest effect that I've seen him use it in the office.
Well, and he's playing the relationship with Burroughs very effectively, right? And that's, I think that's kind of the key.
Let's talk about Dustin Burroughs.
And Burroughs, we've kind of wound up backing into talking about, I want to start with a general non-analytical observation, but I will say this. Having spent a lot of time watching what's going on and watching House proceedings, among the many other things you might say, Dustin Burroughs is enjoying what he's doing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Guy's having a good time up there.
Well,
most of the time,
Well, and I think that's the thing. I mean, just to go back a beat on Dustin Burroughs, and I don't, obviously I don't know him at all, but like this guy fascinates me. As someone who watches politics, I want to see what his next move is. And I'm not saying that in the sense of like, oh, is he going to run for House? I want to see, because look, I'm going to say this right now.
What consolidated speakership looks like.
Yeah, because I'm going to say right now, he comes back, he is not going to get a minority of the Republican caucus.
Doesn't look like it.
He's very likely going to have, a pretty healthy
To your earlier point, not that he couldn't change his mind, but Donald Trump has endorsed him for re-election and for speaker.
Right. And I'll say this, this is crazy, he doesn't even need it right now, I don't think.
But it's not going to hurt.
But it's not going to hurt. And I think, if you think about this guy's history, and I remember, when sort of the fracas was starting over who would be the next speaker and all this kind of stuff, and Dustin Burroughs kind of came out of, I don't want to say the shadows, because that's not fair. I mean, it's complicated. But when he came out as sort of like, oh, Dustin Burroughs, you're like, Dustin Burroughs? Really? I mean, it's like, it's not that Dustin Burroughs had his hand on the knife, but he was like there in the getaway car not long ago in terms of like going after other House members. And yet the idea that, this is the person who then gets elevated to lead the body. Now, to me, what that says, now, like, I'm not saying that with any criticism at all. What I'm saying is, wow, this is someone who really understands the politics. The fact that, you're running for speaker, you've got the state party, you've got huge funders, you've got a majority of the Republican caucus saying no. And nonetheless, you know how to manage the thing to still get there. And then at the end of the process, you're probably solidified your speakership. It's like, that's pretty impressive work, again, within the context of where things are. Now, look, to your point about the relationships, I mean, Patrick's his power, he's new, but it's going to be interesting to see how this relationship develops over time.
Yeah, I think so.
I'll also say one other thing, I'll stop. Yeah. But the other thing that everyone, I think was saying about Burroughs, which is true all along, is like, look, this is a very conservative member. And I think one of the things that really has probably helped him in his relationship with the other in that relationship with both Patrick and Abbott is the fact that, if you have to remember, Burroughs authored the Death Star Bill. Burroughs has a much more top-down view of, I think state power vis-a-vis the localities than has probably been the modal tendency in the House maybe sometimes.
Well, I think what I would say about that is, I take that as, I think one of the, what I would bolt on to that whole characterization is the most immediate point would be, it turns out he's probably kind of a leading indicator though of what is going on in the Republican Party.
That's right.
Which starts another bigger conversation we won't have today that we were having this morning about governance, the mode of governance and the use of state power and the underlying theory of the case of what state government should be doing. The other thing I would add to that is that, Burroughs became one of the great illustrations, I think now in retrospect, and I don't think I probably said this at the time, but of why all the obsessive early attention to the speaker's race is kind of a waste of time.
Right.
And not because I don't think he was so much, he was veiled in a way.
Yeah.
Right.
That's better.
But, but when he emerged, it's not like people went, oh, I never would have thunk.
No, right.
Right. No. It's like, it was very much like, oh, okay.
Yeah, and if he pulls it off, you say, okay.
There's that other shoe dropping.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. That was the person that we weren't talking about.
Because he was embedded in that faction. It was one of the things he was criticized for.
Right.
Right. I mean, he is embedded. I mean, he has very powerful allies in the House community and in the party community is when we think about kind of the subgroups and the cliques and the, the different corners of the caucus and of the party. But yeah, I mean, I think it's been a very you know, it's been, you know, there's a point in the middle of this, and I think we did this on the podcast a few weeks ago, where after the last couple of sessions, you know, really Bonin and then the Phelan sessions, we never really, it always just seemed like not business as usual.
Mm-hmm.
And there came a point in this session where to me, it began to feel like, you know, things are kind of, I mean, the politics have changed.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things have changed.
Right.
But it feels like a lot of this session has just kind of gone a little bit more functioning within normal parameters.
Yeah, it fits more into your expectations of how you, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, to your
how
point,
we expect things to work, given conditions, however unusual and unique the conditions of every session.
Yeah, well, we get lots of questions about the timelines and the calendars and how many bills are being paid and all this kind of stuff and like whether this is normal or not. And in a lot of ways, like this has felt like a very normal session. I mean,
right now, saying that. The reason I'm hedging all those other, you know, there's still all these other things going on. There are other things about the way things are working in the legislature that almost universally, when you talk to people that have been in this a while, are going, you know, this thing has really changed.
Yeah.
Right? But I guess what I'm trying to reconcile in that characterization as I'm thinking here in real time is how you match those two things, right? I mean, on one hand, a lot of the expected institutional patterns and procedures and, you know, the rhythm of the session and the feel of what's going on and the axes of conflict and, you know, what people are fighting over, that has sounded more, felt more normal, even as other things have really changed that have to do with, you know, probably polarization and have to do with, you know, some of these other things we're talking about, shifting Republican theories, you know, approaches to governance. You know, the shifting nature of what's going on in the Republican Party, frankly.
This is super value-laden, and I don't mean to use this word, and I know you'll probably, you know, use this as a jumping off point, but I mean, would you say it's more like the norms are changing? Or is it?
Yeah, well, I think that's part of it. Yeah. No, I do think that is part of it.
Yeah.
Right? How many times, you know, do you have to people say, you know, yeah, I don't know, you can't really talk to members anymore. Or if you talk to members, like people are less persuadable.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the top, you know, the increased top-down nature of what's going on,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? And so I, you know, I'm backtracking a little bit. I'm not really backtracking. I just want to qualify this normalcy thing because there are a lot of other things that are different that are going on there.
Well, yeah.
That I think are important and I think we'll probably pull out more once we get to the end and see what the actual product is. But I do think that, you know, and look, we could be making this, or I could be making this a lot more complicated than it needs to be.
Oh, surely we are. Just hold on.
That it's just about, you know, it, when you don't have a, what we're seeing is the normal, you know, this goes back to something you've been saying as we've been putting this class together that you've been kind of leaning on a lot, which is this, to the extent that everything we see here is about a system that seeks to contain, modulate, channel conflict.
Conflict and interests, yeah.
I think what we saw a little bit in the previous sessions, and certainly the, you know, the last 2023, which was just, you know,
mm-hmm.
will go down in history as the, you know, the off-the-hook year in the Texas mm-hmm. legislature and Texas politics because of the Paxton thing, but because of the, you know, the intense public animosity between the speaker and the lieutenant governor. Part of it may just be like, for all the conflict we're seeing, and, you know, I was talking about, you know, we keep referring to the far right members and what's mm-hmm. going on the floor. But it does seem like at some basic level, what we may just be saying is, you know, the conflict has just been a little more modulated in a way that falls within the usual institutional patterns, saying nothing about the terms of the conflict or the theories being that are being fought out there. You know, the institutional containment was just a little more better this time.
a little more better.
All right.
Sounds like a good place to stop.
Yeah. What else? Anything else you got to close with in terms of what we're looking at?
You know, I mean, there's a million. I mean, obviously,
I mean, there's a lot.
I mean, I just, you know, let me mention some things that like we're not talking about today because just so that we're not like, you know, flogged for things. I mean, look, there's a lot of abortion stuff still going on. The clarification bill has been sent to the governor. You know, there's still discussions going about pills, about travel, and those are going to be, you know, if they, you know, when they do come up, they will be contentious, right?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I, you know, we didn't say this, but it's in the piece, and I want to point this out. You know, on Patrick and the hemp stuff. And it's one of the really important things about this. I really suggest you go read the piece because I think it's actually pretty okay. Yeah. And I don't think that
let us recommend our own piece.
Well,
to
you know, I don't. I mean, it's very rare that I like say, "Oh, go look at my work." I mean, very rare. It's not my way. But you know, the point that we're actually showing that piece is like that's not really a popular position based on what we know about underlying attitudes,
yeah.
right? I think you know you can frame it, you can massage it, you can shape it in a way. I think look, a lot of people in the state would say, "Yeah, we don't need vape shops next to schools selling CBD and THC yeah. products." I think that's pretty easy. But in general, you know, people's attitudes on marijuana are you know tend to be pretty open, is what I would say. And you know, when we asked specifically about sort of this broader prohibition, we saw majority opposition in the state, and even among Republicans, it was pretty much split.
Right.
So it's just to say, so and this is sort of one of those things is when we're talking about, you know, why does this one stand out to us so much? I should just add, I think part of the reason is that, you know, just to sum it up, it's like the House actually had like a body of work and sort of had been building up kind of as the House does over multiple sessions, these ideas around maybe we don't want to be criminalizing all of these activities.
Yeah.
Patrick has basically been clear in saying, I don't really care. I mean, I think this is on the record. So I'm like, I don't really care where the public is going. Like, I'm not going to legalize marijuana. And ultimately, Patrick's preference won out over both public sentiment, House's trajectory. Yeah. And like, that's what we mean. We're saying like, that's why it sort of stands out to us.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. Yeah, no, that's a good point to clarify. And we, you know, there are interesting things in that piece in which we kind of parse out. Something that we often talk about, but we don't always chase it right all the way down in the way that I think we chased it all the way down in that, which is, you know, here's the overall public opinion. Yeah. Here's all Republicans, but then here's the most conservative voters in Texas.
Right.
And, you know, this is where, again, I think the lieutenant governor, this is just an issue that he has strong views of, and he probably just doesn't care about what public opinion polling is telling him. But nonetheless,
he's not going
to pay
for
the extent
it.
That somebody is still going to sit in front of him, you know, and doing the analysis, you know, this is still, he's still probably on decent ground with the Republican primary voters, if not everyone else. And that's not nothing.
Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So, with that, I would just say, for those of you that are going to be working this weekend, good luck.
Yeah. Good luck to you.
You know, may you, you know, bring home or kill the things that you are focused on, one side or the other. And I think we will probably be able to come back next week for a podcast, probably another Friday podcast next week,
probably.
I suspect. But until then, keep an eye out, on our website. You know, we'll probably try to push a little, I'm hoping we'll push a few smaller things out during the end game. And then, we'll come back with some probably bigger kind of assessments of this once everybody catches up on sleep and we get some other work done, and we'll come back and kind of look at this all. And of course, we'll be doing some post-session polling early in the summer, so keep an eye out for that too. So with that, thanks to Josh for being here on a Friday with a holiday weekend coming up. Not that you aren't committed, but still, it's the Friday before holiday weekend. For some people,
I'm only not feeling outed by that because if anybody knows you,
yeah, well, you know, I'm doing a lot of Friday work in these
I know
days.
You
thanks again to our excellent production team in the dev studio here in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin and our, you know, excellent audio studio. Again, find all the stuff, all the polling we've referred to, writing, et cetera, at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Thanks to you all for listening, and we'll be back next week with another Second Reading Podcast. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.